Thank you for tuning into CITR 101.9 FM. You're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly hour-long news report bringing you alternative and undercover current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. It's about 4 past 5, and I am Rahmatullah Sheikh.
And I'm Alex DeBoer. We'll start today's show with a report on the Tibetan Uprising Day rally and vigil that took place in Vancouver this past Saturday. This annual event has been happening in Vancouver for decades. Democracy Watch interviews organizer Maddie Burnaby of the Canada Tibet Committee and Tenzin Yudin of Students for a Free Tibet, as well as the Boston-based activist Ladin Tetong, one of the most prominent voices in the global struggle for Tibet.
Yeah, we have more. We then turn to an interview with Lama Mugabo, an organizer with the Carnegie Community Action Report, a group that champions the rights of downtown Eastside low-income residents. He discusses the group's recently released 2017 hotel survey and housing report and what it means to defend the epicenter of Vancouver's housing crisis. Some really interesting things coming out of that report.
Indeed.
The show ends with a report, again, from outside the BC Supreme Court houses. Democracy Watch reporter Arika Riaz, who's with us in the studio, interviews local activist David Miviser, who has been using direct action tactics, to cause delays in Kinder Morgan pipeline construction. Looks like it's paying off. Miviser and his 14 fellow activists are now being sued by the Texas oil giant for allegedly causing over $1 billion in losses. But first, we're going to bring you headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. Stay tuned.
Is West Bank building social housing? Ian Gillespie of the Vancouver real estate development firm West Bank has made a bid to the federal government to build 50,000 units of affordable housing. If accepted, this affordable housing will be built under the independent nonprofit society Creative Housing Society, which was established by Gillespie. Creative Housing Society is proposed as a partnership between West Bank and the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation. The affordable housing, which would be built in both Vancouver and Toronto, is a project valued at as much as $14 billion, and it could become part of Ottawa's national housing strategy. The Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation said that Creative Housing is one of several organizations it is consulting with. In its 2018 federal budget, the government has allocated $1.35 billion of new money to the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corporation for building more rental housing for Canadian families. Creative Housing's goal is to build mostly rental stock designed for medium-income households. The median income in Vancouver and Toronto is a bit less than $800,000 per year, according to Stats Canada. So that's definitely not low income. Regardless of whether Creative Housing's proposal is successful with the federal government, the Canadian Mortgage and Housing Corp will be playing a key role in some sort of rental construction financing initiative. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah, not sure we're going to reach that median income anytime soon.
Yeah.
Well, now next, the legal battle to ban protesters from Trans Mountain Terminal continues. And Arika Riaz has that news for us. What do we have?
Yeah, so basically a lawyer for Trans Mountain hearings have been going on since yesterday. Trans Mountain is trying to block protesters from entering the Burnaby construction terminal. No decision has been made yet, and as of 2 hours ago, the decision is probably going to be delayed till tomorrow, if later. A lawyer for Trans Mountain told a judge on Wednesday that activists have strategically planned to expand blockades and prohibit construction projects at the Burnaby Mountain and Westbridge Marine Terminals before a mid-March deadline to meet environmental standards. The project is intended to link a new terminal with the federally approved Trans Mountain pipeline and also increase the flow of bitumen from Alberta to the BC coast. The potential environmental hazards have been publicized by protesters, activists, and among them are First Nation groups, and many proponents of the project suggest construction will be in direct violation of First Nations rights.
Mm-hmm. And you were there at the courthouse, was it yesterday or the day before?
It was yesterday. I talked to some of the activists who Trans Mountain and Kinder Morgan are directly suing, and mm-hmm. we're going to be continuing that story towards the end of our show.
Excellent. Sounds good.
Yeah, a story on family reunification. Now, an Indigenous mother is to get her child back after she was taken away by the province. Nearly 2 months after giving birth, an Indigenous mother will be reunited with her child that was taken away from her by British Columbia's child welfare system 3 days after she was born. The mother's identity is being protected. The Huet First Nations received word that a BC provincial court judge ruled the child must be returned to the mother by Saturday, March 17th, that's the day after. The decision on social workers to take the child from the mother resulted in criticism from the province's children's representative, Bernard Richard. Richard said the community has really come out quite strongly in support of this mother. They're providing resources to her, and they're asking the court to be able to help her stay in close proximity to her mother. The BC government has said it will create new legislation that will give First Nations the ability to move children deemed at risk into homes of family members or others within the communities. Currently, social workers can take children at risk out of the community entirely.
So yesterday, that was Wednesday, a walkout was organized by UBC Indigenous Law Students Association, and it was strategically, purposefully held outside the Peter Allard School of Law, and this location was chosen to represent the systemic and institutionalized discrimination of Indigenous peoples in Canada. And the walkout was in response to the acquittals of Gerard Stanley and Raymond Cormier, who were charged respectively with the deaths of Colton Bushy and Tina Fontaine. According to Don Jawson, a second-year law student who was at the walkout, the purpose of the walkout was to draw awareness to systemic inequalities within the Canadian legal system. The event began with Indigenous organizers playing handheld drums and reciting speeches before a loud fire alarm forced everyone to evacuate the building. With their drums in hand, the organizers then led the crowd onto the grass field outside Allard Hall.
Well, yeah, somehow I didn't notice that on campus yesterday, but I guess I wasn't near the law building. Were either of you aware?
I didn't really see any on-campus coverage, as of yet, at least.
Was there anything written in the UBC?
Not as of now.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. So next we have a temporary modular housing proposed on a Little Mountain site. So the city of Vancouver has put out a proposal for Little Mountain to be the next possible site for temporary modular housing. It will have to be approved by development permit application process, and the city said they will hold community meetings to gather feedback. This is the latest in a series of temporary modular housing, which we've been covering at Democracy Watch. This temporary modular housing is part of the provincial government's project to add 2,000 temporary social housing units across British Columbia for vulnerable populations. The city said that this modular housing will contain 50 units, and it will be 3 stories high with support services available on site. So this is a bit contentious because Little Mountain is a prime real estate location. It's beside Queen Elizabeth Park at 37th and Main, and was sold by the then Liberal provincial government to Holborn Group, which is a property development company, in 2007. It has been the subject of much controversy as it used to contain 223 units of social housing that were demolished shortly after the sale. More than 700 vulnerable residents were displaced as a result. Although the land was sold with the provision that developers would build replacement for the social housing that was lost, it has so far built only a single building with 54 units of social housing, more than a decade after the sale was made. So there's going to be more in Democracy Watch on this housing crisis and the loss of affordable housing units and social welfare rates housing units to come. So stay tuned for more on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for bringing those headlines to us. Now, these were the headlines that you were listening from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. We're going to take a short break, but once we return, Democracy Watch will hear a report from last Saturday's Tibetan Uprising Day. So stay tuned.
Let's see here. God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
Everybody. Let's see here. God, ugh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Ugh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Isn't there anything? Anything? Anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Discorder magazine or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody.
To understand more about fashion.
And we're back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. You just heard headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. So this past Saturday, many in Vancouver's Tibetan Canadian community gathered for a rally and vigil in honor of Uprising Day. March 10th, 2018, is the 59th anniversary of the Tibetan National Uprising against the Chinese government's military occupation. In 1950, China's People's Liberation Army marched into eastern Tibet, defeating the Tibetan army. The occupation has persisted since, using tactics to force assimilation that include suppression of religion, language, culture, and destruction of ancient traditional ways. For example, the forced settlement of nomadic herders in the Tibetan Plateau. On March 10, 1959, tens of thousands of Tibetans took to the streets in Lhasa, Tibet's capital, resisting and rising up against the Chinese government's oppressive rule. Extreme force was used to quell these protests, compelling the 14th Dalai Lama, the current Dalai Lama, to escape to India, where he has lived in exile ever since. He continues to provide guidance and spiritual support to Tibetans in diaspora. So, in Vancouver, this past Saturday, was our local vigil and rally for Tibetan Uprising Day. There were no other media there, I believe. Myself, Alex, and Ramatula Shek, our other reporter, made it to the second half of this vigil and rally. It started out around 1 p.m. outside the Vancouver Art Gallery, where leaders and organizers and activists made speeches. One of those activists is actually someone who is a prominent voice in the global struggle for Tibet. Her name is Ladan Tetong. And Ladan spoke with us. We were very lucky to speak with her. A bit about her background. So she was born and raised in Victoria. And she actually now lives in Boston with her family. But she became a prominent activist and served as the executive director of Students for a Free Tibet. She helped shed a spotlight on China's human rights record during the 2018 Olympics. She's been detained and deported from China for hanging a banner from the Great Wall. This banner read in English and Chinese, "One World, One Dream, Free Tibet." She's also been interviewed by George Strombolopoulos for her activism on the Beijing Olympics in 2008. So basically, Ladan has done a lot of really impressive activism work, specifically on Tibet. And so we were very lucky to interview her. So in this piece you're about to hear, you will hear tape from the second half of the protest and rally, which took place outside of the Chinese consulate at Granville and 16th. And yeah, you'll hear from a member of Students for a Free Tibet, as well as Maddie Burnaby, who's from the Canada-Tibet Committee. So let's take a listen to that report.
These are scenes outside the Chinese consulate on Granville and 16th. It's March 10th, and Vancouver's small but coordinated Tibetan community is marking Uprising Day, as they do every year. In 1959, Tibetans rose up in their nation's capital, Lhasa, in an effort to protect His Holiness the Dalai Lama from perceived threat. Tibet's colonizer, the People's Republic of China, had grown concerned over the Buddhist leader's power over the Tibetan people. Tibetans feared the Chinese would try to take His Holiness's life. As crowds gathered to protect the Dalai Lama in Lhasa, the Chinese army opened fire on masses of unarmed Tibetans, killing thousands. March 10th marks the end of Tibet's remaining sovereignty from China. In 2008, the year China hosted the Beijing Olympics, a series of uprisings also took place in resistance to Chinese rule, which were met, once again, with violence and arrests by the Chinese state. Since 1959, the Tibetan diaspora has remained scattered across the world. Every March 10th, Vancouver's Tibetan Canadian community gathers outside the Chinese consulate on Granville Street to both fight for human rights in Tibet and to honor those who have given their lives to resist Chinese colonization. This is where the demands become louder. While at the protest, the Democracy Watch team met Ladin Tatong. She has been attending the Uprising Day protests in Vancouver at the same spot since she was a kid. We asked her about the significance of the protest.
So my name is Ladin Tatong, and I am here protesting for Tibetan freedom and for Tibetan independence from Chinese rule. I grew up actually here. I don't live here anymore, but I grew up on Vancouver Island, coming here every year to protest with my family, with our very small but very feisty Tibetan community here in Vancouver, coming to this very location outside the Chinese consulate to demand freedom and to shine a light on them for what they're doing in Tibet, for the human rights violations, all the things that they hope the world will not see or will forget. In terms of what they're doing to 6 million Tibetans inside Tibet over the past 6 decades. Every year when we come here, we let this day serve as a reminder both of the history that Tibetans inside Tibet rose up March 10th, 1959, and that led to the escape of the Dalai Lama, but also to bring attention to the issue and the ongoing occupation, the repression, but most importantly, the resistance that continues even to this very minute inside Tibet.
How has the resistance here in the Lower Mainland or in Vancouver and Victoria and the reaction to it, either from the public or the Chinese embassy and their representatives, changed, or has it?
Yeah, it has changed, you know. So I will never forget standing outside this Chinese consulate. We had a 24-hour vigil one time, and people driving by yelling, like, just things. People just did not understand the issue. They didn't, that was in the 80s, say, maybe mid or early 80s. People didn't really know the issue. They did not know the Dalai Lama. Only occasionally were people sort of knowledgeable about what was happening in Tibet or even what Tibet was. And now it's really a totally different world, I would say. Not only is Dalai Lama known globally and recognized by many people as an international figure of peace and as the leader of Tibet, but the rightful leader of Tibet, but people know about the political situation in a way, even if it's not a lot. The average person can tell you, oh yeah, you know, Tibet, right, they're China took the country. Like, they may not be able to give you all the details, but that level of knowledge and awareness has been hard won by continuous effort and activities and, you know, action by Tibetans all over the world and in Tibet.
The rally that ended up outside the Chinese consulate on Granville Street began with speeches earlier in the afternoon in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery. Ladin was one of the speakers.
I was talking about this incredible struggle where 6 million Tibetans, against all odds, faced off against one of the most powerful and populous nations on earth, are not only still alive, but still fighting, and rigorously. And if you think about the odds and you think of where we are now, it's really remarkable. China considers Tibet one of its core interests, one of its like most important issues, and that's crazy when you think that we're not only 6 million people, but we're Buddhist, for the majority of Tibetans are Buddhist, and our leader is a monk. So the fact that not only is the issue still alive, we're still alive, we're still fighting, but we're an international issue, like a global issue of concern. What I said today was that empires fall, rise and fall, and often when the people on the fringes of the empire struggle for their rights and for their freedom, and that in that way they know Tibet is very dangerous for them, and as long as the issue is alive and well, which it is, then they can't rest. And I think that is key and critical to us understanding the impact we can have as a few individuals. Small group here, small group in Boston, small group in New Delhi, in Tokyo, and you name it, we're all around the world today. And the impact we and this small group of Tibetans have had in this world is huge, and on China.
The global reaction to the Tibetan cause may have changed, but there's been very little response from Chinese officials in Vancouver. Laden told us about the only time she has ever seen anyone in the Chinese consulate acknowledge the passionate protesters outside their gates.
For the most part, they avoid us at all costs. I remember when I was young, standing here and really having like a moment where I saw a few Chinese men behind the gates there smoking and laughing at us, and just thinking about all that was lost by all these people. At that time, my grandmother was alive here in Vancouver, and you know, her whole family, her children got trapped in Tibet after 59, and just that moment, it felt like that was kind of the most engagement we ever had. To now, you know, I would say Chinese Canadians or overseas Chinese students, they don't necessarily join us or support us. I think some do, but they can't do it openly. I think many more are conflicted about this issue, or maybe even totally against us, because of the propaganda that they've been raised with their whole lives. And I was saying earlier to someone, I would challenge all the young Chinese who don't like us or don't think Tibet is a legitimate issue. I bet you there are young people who know that the Communist Party and the Chinese government has a lot of things wrong with it, and know that they get lied to on a lot of issues. And if that is possible and all the other issues that I know they care about, then chances are it's probably true on Tibet. And I would just challenge them in a free and open society to look into this on their own. Because I know certainly all of us have had to face Chinese propaganda on Tibet, have had to look at China's version of events, have had that thrust in our face over our lives, even still today. And we understand it. We understand where it comes from. It's, you know, it's important that they do the same.
Almost 60 years since the violent events in Tibet gave rise to Uprising Day, it is the young generation of Tibetans who help keep the cause alive. The March 10th rally in Vancouver was largely organized by a group called Students for a Free Tibet. We spoke to one of the organizers, Tenzin Yuren. She is a high school student and grew up in a Tibetan community in India before moving to Vancouver. We asked her how much the average Canadian understands about the situation in Tibet.
Quite a lot of people know what's going on in Tibet and all that, more than what I've expected, because I also used to live in Singapore, so hardly anyone knew about it. But here, there are a lot of people who know about like what's happening in Tibet. I attend school, and there's this girl in my school. Her name is Lhasa. And I was kind of shocked to find out her name is Lhasa, because Lhasa is the capital city of Tibet. And first I thought it was just a coincidence, but she told me that, I asked her what her name means. She said it's actually the capital city of Tibet. And I was like, people actually know about Lhasa. I mean, for people to know about Tibet, yeah, I mean, Tibet is a country, but Lhasa is a city. So for someone to be named Lhasa, it's kind of a huge deal.
And as part of the Students for a Free Tibet, do you as a group organize many protests, or how do you engage and bring this issue up with like Canadians?
As you can see, there are a lot of signs here. Everything was made by SFT. And as for like bridging the gap between Canadians and Tibetans, like this interview, and there have been other interviews that other members of SFT have done.
One of the complaints that people had was that they usually have these protests, but then there is very little response from the Chinese authorities. Have you, in your experience while protesting, ever been confronted by the Chinese authorities where they've responded to any of your agitations?
No.
And why do you think this happens?
I think Well, when it first started, I think everyone was shocked. But we've been doing this every year, and I think people just got used to it. People are starting to ignore it. And the more ignorance there is in the world, the more desperate we become. We want our freedom.
Tenzin says Canada offers the political freedom that the Tibetan community needs to highlight humanitarian violations happening in Tibet. And that freedom motivates her to continue fighting for a free Tibet.
How do you see yourself being involved in this cause while staying in Vancouver in the months that come along?
Well, I feel like I have more power here in attending the marches and everything. In India, while we did march and all that, there was like hardly any response from like the society itself. In a sense, like, if we were marching, no one actually cared because they see this every day. But I think over here, people don't really see it a lot. And when we do march, they just get really surprised. And they're like, what's happening? They're filming it. And I feel like this kind of brings like more coverage to the society because social media is a huge thing. They're filming it. They put it out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all that. So I feel like this has more impact.
In Canada, the Tibetan struggle is gradually moving from street protests to policy and government chambers. The Democracy Watch team met Maddie Burnaby, a member on the board of directors for the Canada-Tibet Committee. A backpacking trip to Tibet in 1988 is what sparked her activism for the Tibetan cause. And now, after 30 years, Maddie is lobbying political parties and government institutions to keep China's businesses in line with Canada's environmental and human rights responsibilities.
We got letters of support this year from all three of the major parties, NDP, Conservative and Liberal, expressing support and solidarity on March 10th. And so I read those three letters. And all were very strong and very knowledgeable. And to me, that speaks to the success of that aspect of the work that NGOs are doing, but also Tibetans and a global, globally.
And Maddie is seeing some progress. Her lobbying has led to some accountability in British Columbia's mining industry.
It wasn't directly a complaint to the Chinese government, but what we did was lodge a request for review to Canada's contact point for the OECD around China Gold International, complaining that they appear to be in breach of OECD guidelines on human rights and environment. The company didn't comply and they didn't agree to communicate, didn't agree to mediation, and the contact point made an unprecedented ruling that said that and they couldn't come up with a finding on China Gold because China Gold refused to participate. That belligerence and refusal to participate in any way meant that they were held to account in Canada. China Gold is a BC-based company, though it's owned and operated by Chinese Beijing-based people who are mostly high-level people connected with the Communist, the Communist Party of China. The consequence that they faced was that the Canadian government has now barred them from any of the supports that Canadian companies might get from government. And things like joining the club on Canadian trade missions to foreign countries. So, and that was a major slap in the face for them. It didn't sort of necessarily cost them dollar-wise, but shame and losing face and losing a whole array of contacts, it was a major blow. So they are no longer allowed to go on any Canadian government or BC government-related trade missions. They're not allowed to be part of that entourage anymore.
You've been listening to a story on Democracy Watch on how the Tibetan community in Vancouver marked the uprising day on March 10th. This was brought to you by News Collective members Alex DeBoer and me, Rahmatullah Sheikh.
All right, and this is Democracy Watch. You just heard a report on Tibet Uprising Day. So we now turn to an exclusive interview with the Carnegie Community Action Plan organizer, Lama Mugabo. Earlier this week, the Carnegie Community Action Plan released their 2017 Hotel Survey and Housing Report. This report, which has been released annually for the past decade, estimates that 1,200 homeless people live in the downtown east side. It found that over 500 downtown Eastside residents were evicted from their homes through no fault of their own in the last year. There have only been 21 new units of housing built at welfare rate to compare to that 500 that were lost. Average rents in privately owned hotels are now $687 per month on average, which is a $139 increase from last year. The number of people in downtown Eastside who are on welfare and disability increased by almost 100 people in the last year. So those were just a few of the highlights. So I spoke with Lama this afternoon, and we're now going to play an interview with him and then have a little bit of a discussion. So please stay tuned. Here we go.
Very briefly, what the Carnegie Community Action Project is and what your role is within that group?
Okay. Carnegie Community Action Project, the project of the board of the Carnegie Community Center Association. And CCAP works mostly on housing, income in the downtown side, so that the area can remain a low-income friendly community. And my role is a community organizer.
Okay, so you also kind of help coach and train residents in the downtown Eastside on how they can advocate for themselves as renters?
Correct.
Great. So in March, City Council heard staff give a three-year review of the Downtown Eastside Local Area Plan. I was wondering if you could explain what that plan is.
So the Downtown Local Area Plan, so it looks at the development of Downtown Eastside, and we work with the residents, but also with the city to make sure that the development is consistent with what people want.
Right.
So that we have been vocal that we don't want our community to be gentrified. So it's a constant and organic relationship that involves push and pulling, which is fine. I mean, but it's healthy for a city like Vancouver.
Right, right. So, but in the city's three-year review of the Downtown Eastside Local Area Plan, were they pleased with the results? Had everything been on track, or how did the review go?
It didn't go well, and in fact, we took issue with the plan and how access is on social media. So we want more housing that people can afford.
Right.
And the idea behind social media, the argument is that if you have a diverse community, but not income diverse. And we argue that in order for us to thrive, we need jobs, we need economic development. We don't just need to live next to rich people.
Right.
And also, if you want to social mix, mm-hmm. it's not just downtown side. You should also think about Point Grey and other wealthy areas.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah.
So in the report, the Carnegie Community Action Project's 2017 Hotel Survey and Housing Report, the Region Hotel is brought up, and it was condemned almost a year ago now.
The Balmoral.
Sorry, the Balmoral. Yes, you're correct.
Balmoral.
Yeah, the Balmoral was the one who was closed down in June, I believe, of 2017. So I'm very interested to hear how you think the city administration was able to continually fail to enforce its own standards of maintenance as outlined in section 23.8, which you bring up in the report, which stipulates that if a landlord fails to comply with required building repairs, the city has the authority to do the repairs and then bill the owner. And also, this is part of a larger issue, right, of SROs violating building and health codes to the extent to which they become unlivable and then condemned. So back to my original question is, how did the city allow the Balmoral to get to this point?
So we've seen this happen in the past. I remember that in Hogan Valley, the community was allowed to fall apart.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, exactly.
A blight, which gave reason for the city to bring in urban renewal policy and mm-hmm. build by that. And as a result, the Black community lost core, lost our home.
Mm-hmm.
In the downtown side, when you look at how those buildings have been allowed to fall apart, wonder whether this is an accident or is it designed. How can the city fail to enforce its own bylaw for over 30 years to allow a building like the Balmoral to be condemned because everything was moldy and it was actually, you know, people fear that it would collapse. So that means we lose 160 units. And this sends us to scramble to find housing for 168 people in the middle of a housing crisis. Certainly, someone's left behind the wheel, and we want to make sure that this doesn't happen again. And more importantly, we want the city to buy Balmoral Hotel and prevent it to be gentrified so that it can build housing that's affordable.
And then the report also discusses how other SROs, like the Roden Lodge and the Jubilee Room, and then the Balmoral, which is still in question what will happen, but the Roden Lodge, for example, only 140 out of the 157 new units are guaranteed at pension rate, which is actually pretty high, all things considered. And then the Jubilee Room is being renovated, but you suspect the units will probably be rented out at market prices. And then there's also the Quality Inn, which has 157 units which are due to be redeveloped, and most likely those won't be social housing. So in the shadow of all this upheaval, do you remain optimistic that the Cobalt, for example, which is possibly going to be condemned soon, that it will be turned into social housing, or do you think it will also be made into more profitable housing stock?
Yes. Thanks for bringing that up. In total, we lost 500 units and only gained 21 units. When you bring up Cobalt, so what we ask is to remember that housing is a human right, not a commodity. And also we want the provincial government to raise welfare rates, because right now 710 are broke.
Yeah, and that's interesting because the report also talks about how the welfare rate was increased by $100 this year, but at the same time, rent in SROs went up as well. And so there's a suggestion in the report, or it's outright said, that as the government increases welfare and also as nonprofit groups provide rent supplements, such as groups like the Carnegie Outreach, the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, ATIRA, etc. So as the government and nonprofit groups try to help people be able to pay their rent, then landlords raise the rent, knowing that people have a slightly bit more pocket money. So what is the solution to this cycle?
The solution is rent control.
Right.
We want rent, real rent control that ties the cost of the unit not to the tenant, but to the unit. So it's really pivotal that the provincial government puts together a rent control that will protect tenants.
So that's one of your recommendations to the provincial government, is to implement some rent control. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Lama. Do you have any other final points that you want to be on the record?
The only thing I want to say is that Downtown Side is going through a major housing crisis. We are the epicenter at this site. So we need more resources, housing that people can afford, and we need the city to buy these buildings like Balmoral, Region, Cobalt, so that prevent it from being gentrified and allow people to stay.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no worries. Have a nice day.
Bye-bye.
All right. And that was an interview with Lama Mugabo of the Carnegie Community Action Project. He was one of the authors of the 2017 Hotel Survey and Housing Report, which was released on Monday, actually. So I wanted to apologize for the quality of the audio. We did the interview over the phone and did try to find a place where there was better reception, but it still was a bit hard to hear. I just wanted to highlight some of my favorite parts of that conversation and some of the words, some of the wisdom Lama shared, and like from his observation. He's also done a lot of work with the Hogan's Alley community, which, for those who don't know, is Vancouver's Black community that was displaced from Chinatown by the viaducts. And basically what happened there was the city kind of let the area fall apart. They stopped picking up garbage. They
they kind of let it just get really run down, and then they pointed the finger at it and said, look at all this urban blight, which is actually a racist term for communities that are not white and that they feel they can push aside to build, in this case, viaducts. So what he's saying is that he sees similar things happening in the downtown east side with SROs, single room occupancy hotels, where so many vulnerable people live. And so, for example, the housing code that comes up in this report, which stipulates that the city must upkeep buildings to proper maintenance standards. And if that's not happening, they can go in and do repairs and then bill the landlord. That's totally legal, but they don't do that. And this is actually a story that Democracy Watch is doing some reporting on to do with the cobalt. We want to dig into this a bit more, how that happens. But I think it's really interesting that Lama was able to highlight that. And it's a very suspicious kind of situation. I think I had a quote from him in case anyone wasn't able to hear him. He said, "How can the city fail to enforce its own bylaw for over 30 years?" So, yeah, I mean, it's funny. Anyway, we are now going to change gears for the last 15 minutes of the show. We have a report from Arika Riaz, who was at the BC Supreme Courthouses yesterday, speaking with David Mavaser, who's an activist with the Justin Trudeau Brigade. This brigade is a group of individuals who are committed to using direct action to halt or at least slow down the expansion of the Kinder Morgan pipeline terminal in Burnaby. So this group, David, as well as 14 others, were recently sued by Kinder Morgan for over $1 billion. Kinder Morgan alleges that they have caused them that amount in losses due to these direct actions. So Arika had a chance to speak with David, and let's turn to that story and see what he has to say.
"Governments might grant permits, but only communities can grant permission." That is a quote from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau from back in 2013, and that is exactly what happened this past Saturday in Burnaby. Tens of thousands of protesters from across Canada, from community organizers to concerned citizens, activists, NGOs, were all collectively protesting the continued expansion and building of the Kinder Morgan pipeline. So we have a very powerful movement happening in BC right now. There's a lot of momentum. There's a lot of community and Canada-wide support for anti-Kinder Morgan protesters. So directly preceding last Saturday's march, the Texas-based firm Kinder Morgan filed an injunction within the BC Supreme Courts. And so what they're trying to do is get permission to arrest anyone within 50 feet of any zone in the Kinder Morgan pipeline construction site. Protesters and community activists and organizers literally going every single day, every single week to try to physically deter or physically block construction of the Kinder Morgan pipeline, or just being on the sites and protesting and showing that they're not okay with this. So if this injunction goes through, anyone on these grounds without a permit will be subject to arrest. Yesterday was the first day of hearings regarding this injunction at the BC Supreme Court, so CITR headed over and talked to Rabbi David Mavaser, who has been on our show before. He's founder of the Trudeau Brigade, and he is one of the activists on the front lines of anti-Kinder Morgan movement. We talked to him about what exactly he and other activists who had been personally mentioned in the injunction claim were trying to do at the court.
So the outcome of the hearing itself is predetermined. There's no chance that anything is going to happen other than Kinder Morgan is going to completely get its way with this injunction. So why do I bother coming down here? So I can get the message out about the big picture, right? The big picture. So I am, God willing, I'll be able to speak in the court. I have standing, and the judge might let me finish what I'm saying, even though I'm not getting paid $400 an hour and speaking for 4 hours. I'd hope in 5 minutes to say that fundamental consideration for the injunction is that we are causing irreparable harm to Kinder Morgan, or specifically to Trans Mountain Pipeline. I want the judge to consider that we're not causing harm. We are not causing them harm. We are going to save them hundreds of millions or billions of dollars that they're sinking into a completely losing project. And I can articulate that more. No petroleum products are shipped from here to Asia. There's a pipeline that's been there for 50 or 60 years. Asia doesn't want Alberta's diluted bitumen. It's heavy, dirty stuff. They don't want it. There's so many reasons why this project's going to fail. And Kinder Morgan has already communicated that to their shareholders. This is, you know, so I just want to get the message out. We're not causing irreparable harm.
Kinder Morgan is causing public good irreparable harm.
Right. Right. But, you know, their claim is we're causing them harm. I think that's a contention that is very contestable.
You're involved with the Justin Trudeau Brigade.
Yes.
And you have been talking about moving beyond just peaceful protests.
Yeah, so what we need to do is move beyond protests. We've been protesting this for at least 5 years, right? I've signed petitions that have been signed by about 150,000 other people. It didn't work, right? Soon after the Trudeau government was elected, we had a protest demonstration of 5,000 people walking through the streets of Vancouver, and then they decided let the pipeline go through anyway, right? I've spoken with my MPs. We have lots and lots of protest. We can get out on the water in kayaks and have flags and banners and songs and drums and prayers. The pipeline goes ahead. So I'm totally convinced that we need to go beyond protest and directly intervene and physically stop what Kinder Morgan is doing. A few of us have done that so effectively that they're suing us for $1 billion a year loss. If anyone would read the affidavits that they submitted with their application for this injunction, you can see they're claiming we've caused them losses of something in the order of millions of dollars a week. I don't dispute that. That's exactly what we're doing. The problem is there's only been a few dozen of us. If there was 500 of us in waves, 15 at a time, bring on this injunction. If 15 of us go out and just block the traffic, police will come and arrest us, take us away. Another 15 come and block the traffic. Police come again, take us away. If we had 100 people in one day, tie them up for a whole day, and then the courts will be tied up. Another 100 people the next day, tie them up. Don't do a thing with lots of people all at one time. That's not accomplishing as much as spread us out. Be strategic and think about the tactics that are going to produce the outcome that we all want, which is stop Kinder Morgan.
Do you have advice for other community activists? Like you said, we need to be organized in this.
Question.
How can we be organized?
I'm going to say something I've never said in public before, but I think it needs to be heard. I have approached the large, well-resourced, professionally staffed environmental NGOs since October, and some of them hang up the phone on me. They don't talk with us. They have their own thinking and their own agenda, and they're pursuing it. They're not working together with a group of people with no resources except our own bodies, who in the course of 3 months has brought Kinder Morgan to the point where they're bringing in the Supreme Court of our province and the RCMP to stop us, because they know we are holding them up. We are stopping them. So what I'm saying is, first, to answer your question, work together better. That's one thing. But again, I think if all they do is just stay there, Kinder Morgan will work around them. And I think that the Tsleil-Waututh have the authority to invite other people to come with them and shut down Kinder Morgan. Again, you know, if If 50 of us would commit to doing it each day in waves of even five, I mean, even one person can hold up a whole line of trucks and bulldozers and everything else. Get arrested and another person steps out. The Tsleil Waututh are doing a great thing by planting their watch house there. But just watching. I know they're thinking bigger than that. I know they have a plan. I know they do, and they will. And I hope, you know, we can all, like, line up behind them.
All right. So that was an interview and story by Arika Riaz.
Yeah, so just to start off the discussion, I also talked to David about, or Rabbi David, about whether or not comparisons of Kinder Morgan and what's happening there, if it's fair to compare it to what happened at Standing Rock in the United States. And he was saying that, you know, Standing Rock, it wasn't a failure in that so many people, like literally hundreds of thousands across North America, mm-hmm. showed up to protest. And, you know, we were emailing senators and we had a lot of momentum in that movement. But ultimately, at Standing Rock, the pipelines were still built despite our direct action. And I think that's what David is saying, that, you know, we want that kind of momentum that Standing Rock had, but that shouldn't be our ultimate goal, in that we actually need to stop this pipeline. Mm-hmm. And the only way to do that is for, you know, community activists and organizers and just anyone who's concerned to actually come up with concrete actions and outcomes of our actions.
Right. So, yeah, this comparison to Standing Rock, I think that I heard it on a podcast I was listening to, some news program I heard. So can you explain, like, a bit about why Kinder Morgan is being compared to Standing Rock? Is that in light of this weekend's large protest, or what do you think the reasons are?
I mean, they're both pipelines, obviously, and they're both being built by transnational firms that obviously do not have people's interests in mind, and they're both encroaching on the rights of First Nations. I mean, both of our governments are already doing that, but the pipeline especially, it's kind of an irreversible thing. Like, we can't go back once mm-hmm. this pipeline is built, and those people are going to lose their lands. And I think also, you're right, it's because of the protests. Like, the numbers that came out, literally 10,000 people from across Canada, maybe even outside of Canada. Mm-hmm. And I think the movement is definitely comparable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because when you were putting this piece together, we were doing some editing. I did mention how you didn't include the counter protesters, which were about 200 people. But I think you had a really good reason for why that was. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, outlets like CBC, Global News, etc., they were covering both protesters. Like, they did cover the anti-Kinder Morgan protesters in mm-hmm. Burnaby, but the size of the anti-Kinder Morgan protests were triple, maybe even more, the size of the pro-supporters.
Oh, much more than triple, I think. Yeah, it was okay, like 10,000 versus 200.
But the media coverage made it seem like the same amount of people were on both sides. Like, they mm-hmm. gave equal standing to the support at the protesters in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was very, very biased. And it almost made it seem like there are more people, if not just as many people, in favor, when in reality it seems like most people within the community do not support CAM.
Yeah, I saw a photo essay, which I think was by the CBC, not to throw them under the bus. But in the number of photos were almost equal between the two protests. So, and I did think about that as well. Yeah, I hadn't actually heard that a counter protest would take place. It took place, the one I know of, took place at Jackpool Plaza in Vancouver. There were apparently about 200 people there. A lot of them were wearing shirts that said "I Heart Canadian Oil and Gas." So that happened.
And it's possible that, a number of them might have had affiliations with companies that would potentially profit from Kinder Morgan.
Yeah, some of the people there obviously, like, are employed by oil and gas. People have different perspectives. That's fine. I think just it's interesting to comment on the media coverage mm-hmm. of the two different protests. I'm wondering, did you get to talk to David much about this actual lawsuit against him and his fellow activists? Is he frightened at all, or is he kind of shrugging it off?
Well, he was very confident. He was like, we know this is happening, but we don't care. Like, that's not going to deter us from taking action. And, you know, that was very, very powerful to see. So the hearings are still going on as of today, even though they were supposed to end yesterday. Apparently they're being dragged out, I guess, to kind of deter people from coming or from saying their pieces. So David has said that there's like a 95% chance that the injunction will be granted in favor of Kinder Morgan. And then after that happens, basically people like David or activists who are at the construction zones will literally be arrested.
Right. And of course, like I was saying to you earlier, this reminds me of back in, 2014 with on Burnaby Mountain, when there was an injunction against surveying, against the survey site of this terminal, and people began getting arrested. There was some violence. It was making a lot of headlines. And so, yeah, if this injunction goes through, which it seems like it will, we will probably be seeing some more arrests.
In terms of, you know, suing David and the other 14 activists, well, the arguments that they're making in court, like today, is that, you know, they're exercising their constitutional rights. They're not building blockades in, in like, in the way of construction. They're just blocking with their bodies, and they have a right to do that because technically that is protesting. So as of now, nothing has been 100% decided.
Yeah. No, interesting. Good point. Right. So it's now 6 p.m. That is the end of our time on Democracy Watch. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. It's your local source of news on undercovered and marginalized communities in Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. We are here every Thursday at 5 p.m., so please join us again next week and stay tuned for more programming on CITR. Thanks so much. Bye.